This will be the last one in the group called the Post-Diluvian Reconstruction. And what I want to do is to set us up for the transition that takes place between old paganism and new paganism, old in the ancient sense, new in the ancient sense, archaeo-paganism, what we've been describing. And we begin to enter into a new period where all of these old things don't work so well anymore. The world changes. That's one of the problems with human religion, is that it only works as long as everything stays the same. Divine religion works no matter what the conditions are, because it isn't centered on man or his circumstances. It's centered in on God. And so therefore, as long as, you know, God can be doing dynamic changes all over the place, and his people still stay the same, because they believe in standards. They don't believe in their views of reality. And where reality is constantly in flux, your religion constantly has to be in flux as well. This affects a lot of things, especially as your religion gets deeper and deeper engrafted into your society, as it did, because mythology was absolutely essential to the society. It became the history of the society. It became its uber history. It explained the meaning behind things. It told them something about the direction that they were going in, where they had come from. It told them also something about where things were going. There was always an eschatology involved in paganism. For instance, the Norse mythology had the eschatology of the Ragnarok, which told about the end of the world, how the world was going to end. Interestingly enough, the Ragnarok sure does resemble premillennialism. Okay, there's a lot of elements involved that are very similar between the two. So it gives direction. It gives some degree of idea about the future of the nation and so forth. It's very important in society. Belief systems, epistemology of any society is important, because if you don't have a common epistemology, then people are going to be making decisions all over the place about all kinds of things out of their own heads, and you don't have a sort of a forward motion of society where society is at least at some degree looking in the same direction. So it's very important. All right. It's very important that the religion stay as stable as possible. Stability wasn't something that that ancient religions could ever achieve. So the best they could do was to try to be as pliable as possible, to try not to be too rigid. In fact, rigid epistemological systems choked in societies. They were not tolerated in societies. That's one reason why Judaism and Christianity were always persecuted, because they were rigid systems. And rigid systems don't work in a malleable body. So these are important. They became very important to them. A period of about roughly 1,500 years goes by from the time of the flood till about the 7th century B.C. And the old pagan system reigns during that period of time all over the earth. Now, it's not always going to look the same everywhere. There are cultural differences from one country to the other, but there are an awful lot of archetypal motifs that are the same all over the world. There is a commonality to it, which gives you the... reinforce the idea that this is right. It's got to be right. Everybody believes this. Even people who don't know us believe this. And doesn't that verify it and give it credibility? It did. So people became more and more entrenched and locked into the pagan system because it was workable, sensible. It took in all of the facts that they cared to have. It didn't take in all the facts, of course, but it took in all the ones that they wanted. And it had credibility. This is the importance of Herodotus. Herodotus goes and he travels around several places in the world, and he goes to the coastal regions, and he talks to the sailors and the merchants and so on, and they tell him stories, and he collects things from the priests in Elephantine and all of these kinds of things. You know, he takes all of these things and puts them together, and he sees common strains here. He sees that the Greek religion is not radically different from the Egyptian religion or the Persian religion or any of the other ones, okay? So as he's doing this, he is doing kind of a comparative religion study. And to a certain degree, it kind of verifies, you know, we're kind of on the right track here. You know, we all generally agree with this. I think that there was a sense among ancient men that that in the beginning there was a truth. And that truth may have been represented by the statue of a man made in the image of God. All right? An image of God, shall we say. Because idolatry, if you think about it, is nothing more than the outworking of what God said when he said, "Let us make man in our image." And so the image of man that becomes idols of gods just makes perfect sense. You know, it just flows out of that concept. All right. They had this idea there that everything at one time was all, it all made a central sort of sense. But unfortunate things took place, whether they're going to say there was a fall or whether they're going to say that the gods were capricious, which is usually what it is, that the gods were capricious and just didn't see things man's way and got mad at men unjustly or whatever, and everything just got all torn up, and this icon of truth was just smashed to pieces and scattered all over the world. And what the quest of man is, basically, is to go around the world and pick all these pieces up and super glue them back together again and try to reconstruct the old truth. But all the pieces can't be found. And since men are scattered all over the world, they find their little chunk of it and they form their religion around that. Maybe they've got a few more pieces of it, and they form their religion around these. And because of the sameness of man in so many social ways, their religions have their great differences from one another, but they have their great similarities to one another. It gives them pliability so that they can meld in and out of one another if necessary, can change somewhat with the circumstances if it doesn't change too badly. The problem is that over time, things began to change a lot. The world began to began to go through certain changes, which made it necessary to start rethinking things. And we'll talk about that more as we go along. I want to get a little bit more into detail on this celestial religion, though. Because this is going to set up something about the nature and direction of these transitions as we begin to move into neo-paganism and the radical changes that begin to take place as we make that move. Remember that after the flood, man is demoralized, all right? He's discovered a God who not only is just and is the judge and has the power, but also has the willingness, if he so desires, to wipe out the entire human race. Now, if you're an enemy of God, and the one thing that you want to do is to win the battle against God, any demonstration on his part of the ability to annihilate the human race is not going to be a welcome thing to you. So you're going to spend a lot of time trying to expiate the divine wrath, and you're going to do all kinds of weird and abominable things in order to do that, and rituals and temples and statues and doing everything you can think of to do it. But at the same time, somewhere in the back of your mind, you're thinking, but you know what? We've got to get the supremacy in all of this. We can't be submissive to the gods. We can't be submissive to the divine. We can't have higher principles than ourselves. We're the controllers. So this sense of autonomy, which has always been in man, is going to raise its head. It's always going to raise its head. I think that when God brought the flood into the world, he very wisely put a terror into the hearts of men that lasted over 1,000 years. But when so many generations went by and the effects of that become more and more forgotten, and we don't see any more floods taking place, and I mean, there may be some local ones and things like that, and yeah, every now and then somebody gets bad and some plagues break loose and stuff, but you know, if we just sacrifice a few children, virgins and things like that, then maybe we can get the gods to change their mind, or if we feed the gods, you know. The Sumerians believed that it was their particular responsibility in life to feed the gods. We are the god feeders. They pass that on to most of the Mesopotamian religion. The Assyrians believe strongly in that too. I think there's a physical reason for that, but I won't go into it right now. But bottom line is there are all these ideas about how to go about satisfying the gods. How long is proud man going to go on doing this before he finally says, look, we're tired of this. We want control. All right. Well, let's explore the cosmic wheel for a moment and see what it is that man is going to do to change his condition. All right, remember that we said that men at one point or another, whether it was antediluvian or post-diluvian, probably antediluvian, but at some point or another, men wanting to somehow or another get some knowledge from up there, the heavens, begin to explore the physical celestial sphere that is above them. The motions of the stars, the planets, the sun and the moon, and the phenomenon of the night skies, mainly the night skies, because that's where you can see more. You can see more out there, all right, in God's territory, so to speak. Now, they're not seeing far enough to see heaven, but you know, you're an unregenerate man, and you don't know any better. That's as far as you can see, so that's where you're going to try to get your wisdom from. And they become very sharp at this. They become extremely intelligent and even become called wise men for being able to do these kinds of things. They are a great benefit to society. Their calendars, their prognostications, and so forth, do serve great benefits throughout the ancient period of time. They become very valued in society. But an interesting thing takes place in the 7th century, and we see it in the early in the first chapter of Daniel, or the second chapter of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the great city-state, looks at his astrologers, and he thinks that they're fakes. He has suspicion about them. Now, where did we go from this becoming a great religion to this great suspicion on the part of the king emperor about these astrologers? All right. Were they really fakers? And did he have the grounds to stand on in saying that? And why? Why does he get to that point? Well, let's see if we can find out. Let's pass through there and see if we can find out. First of all, how does the system work? All right. Up there, everything's going around in circle. Now, that's nice mechanical motion. Man understands that very well. Going in circles is something man can grasp. He does it all the time. All right. So he can get a hold of the idea of running in circles. That's machine motion. It is something to be rendered. All right. Man sees motion, he's always looking at, you know, how can I harness this? How can I render this? All right. Now, he's not just thinking on a physical level, he's thinking on a metaphysical level when he's doing this. So not only is he looking at this physical phenomenon of the motions of the heavens, but he's also thinking spiritually because he knows that he's looking up there into the realm of God. He's looking up into the spiritual realm. So how do we reach out and touch that? How do we bring that down here? All right? Remember, God made man to know him. He made man to be a creature of earth, but a mediator to heaven. Man is the one creature who is not horizontally oriented. He is vertically oriented. He has his feet on the ground and his head in the sky. The animals are all in this direction, okay? Heads down, bodies level with the earth. They are horizon creatures, all right? We are vertical creatures. We are mediatorial creatures, all right? And so God made man to have communion with the spiritual world because there is within man a spirit. But he has a body which gives him communion with the physical world as well. What happens when the spirit dies? You're cut off from that world. And the only way that you can operate is in this world, in the world of corporality. And your senses are going to be the main thing that you're going to use for understanding, and your reasoning, which does interpretation of your senses. And you're also going to be reduced to interpretation. In other words, objective reality is not something that you're really going to be able to articulate. Why? Because you're all that is. That's a real problem if you think about it. If I look at something and I'm all there is, I don't have any other reference point but myself, then how do I know that what I'm looking at is the very same thing that I have an image of in my head? All right? This may be totally, this may be black. All right? Here it's clear. So how do I know? How do I know what the real correspondence is between me and the object? And hold on to that, because that's going to be one of the center points of relativism a long time later. But it's going to pass through the philosophers to get there. But it starts here. It starts at this very place right here. Our inability to pass through that realm. God cut us off from it. He cut us off from heaven. Now, he restores heaven to us through redemption. Not totally. Not in this life. But he does restore it to us in redemption. That's why we can understand the Bible. So he's given us this on earth in order to give us our objective contact with heaven through the Spirit of God. If you're not redeemed, you can't get to that. That's why you can't understand the Bible. So this is our heavenly knowledge right here. The ancient pagan studied literally the sky, the heavens. And what he comes up with is that there has to be a correspondence between that and this down here on earth. And somehow or another, all this going on up here has to have some correspondence going on down here. And we're not talking about the motion of planets here. We're talking about the city-state. All right? Man's society has got to correspond with the society of the spiritual world. And man has got to establish that correspondence by what he observes with his eyes. So, if the heavens are going in a circle, then so must the earth. And the earth must go in a corresponding circle to the heavens. How do you get it to do that? Simple. Cartwheels. All right? Chariot wheels. If you've got one that drives, the other one does what the other one does. All you need to connect them is an axle. All right? So, here you have an order, a state up here. Here you have a state down here. What do you need to connect them together? You need an axle. Now, we build our axle down here. That's why cities and towers went up. Towers reaching up into the sky, as far as you could get those towers to go. Always in the nexus of the city. The tower goes up, and then it is up to us to reach the spiritual side of that axle, which connects it to the celestial sphere. Therefore, in a spiritual sense, we begin to see ourselves in motion and in harmony with the celestial sphere. What that does is bring power and wisdom down the axle rod, which is why the temple is always going to be located at the bottom of the tower, or at the top of the tower. The temple is going to be located there. It's also going to be the housing place of the gods. Most of your huge Colossus statues are going to be there. This is going to be a highly ornate area, lots of ritual going off around this area, the king's palace nearby, all of this kind of stuff. All right. It's a great big machine. And as long as we can tie in to the flywheel up there, then we can pull the power and pull the wisdom down. We can prognosticate. We can have magic. Our rituals will have meaning. We'll receive the blessings of the gods, of the divine. The knowledge will begin to flow down to us more and more. And this is the power of the cosmological view. Understanding this helps us to understand a little bit more of the power of the city-state in those days. The city-state is not just a consortium of men. The city-state is a corresponding city to the celestial city. And all of the correspondence, the better it is, the more parallels there are, the better it is, the more power that there is. So this kicks off a whole bunch of things. First of all, it defines the offices down here. These offices down here are defined by the different hierarchies up here, from God to angels to demons to the dead. Well, there have to be these correspondences down here, from king to grand vizier to priests, prophets, men, and the dead. All right, and there are correspondences between elements. The influences up there have to have elemental correspondences down here: earth, wind, fire, water, down here, which are creation elements, by the way, that are drawn right out of the book of Genesis. All of these things have to correspond to those things up there. And you can make charts of this that can get really complicated, because there has to be a corresponding animal on the earth to the gods. There has to be a corresponding mineral on the earth, gold to the gods, the lion to the gods, those that correspond from the angelic to the earth, etc., etc., etc. And they had all of these things. There was a big system involved that involved all of these kind of things. There are certain things on the earth that catch magic. And you want to gather that magic together in those things, like crystals, certain kinds of plants, certain kinds of animals, things like that, and use them for augury so that you can gain this knowledge to keep your civilization going. That's how the system worked. And it was a very, very logical system. Unfortunately, there was just one big problem with it, and that is that outer space is not quite heaven. So therefore, we have not gone far enough here. But see, this is how they saw it operating. And the city-state amalgamated that familial and pastoral religion into it in the form of the temple, in the form of the statuary, the idols, and so on. And not only does this become a way of channeling power and knowledge down into the city-state so that order and chaos can be overcome and order can reign, all right, but at the same time, and this kind of develops a little bit later, at the same time, this might also serve as a sort of stairway between heaven and earth. And, if by some transcendental and ritualistic means we are able to make our spirits go up there, maybe we can go and gain benefits doing that, so you can get into hallucinogenic drugs and transcendental meditation and all of those kind of things to try to make yourself think your karma or your ba or your ka or whatever it is going up there and leaving your body and coming back. So these ecstatic states are a part of the religion. And maybe if we can sort of imagine that we go up there, maybe the gods will come down. And if they do, let's build a great big mousetrap called a temple. Actually, it's a god trap, all right? And this temple is going to be very palatial and ornate, and inside of it, there are going to be these colossal statues, which are painted, by the way. We don't see this in the ruins, But those naked statues were not only painted to look human with flesh and everything, but they also were clothed and had jewels all over them and crowns on them. And the lights were laid low in the temples to give just the right kind of ambiance. And the torches and so forth were playing on the fleshy look of them to give them a look of animation. Walking into those temples wasn't boring. That was something else. Music going off that sets the tone of how all of this is going, you know. They may, you know, in some cases, they actually had what they called animated statues. You know, in other words, they actually had joints in them. Sometimes you'll see some of these ruined statues that had joints in them. And there was a little marionette work that went on where, you know, maybe you come into the temple and you're worshiping and suddenly Hera turns around and looks at you like that and it scares you to death, you know. And then you are a votive for life. She looked at me, you know, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, these things were going on. Demonic things were going on in there. Supernatural things were taking place because they were opening themselves up to these kind of things as well. The Assyrians actually, remember I said they liked to feed the gods. They actually would come into the temple and lay a table out for the gods with all kinds of delectable food and stuff like that. And the gods in their spiritual forms were to eat that. Now, they, you know, all of the priests would go off in behind a divider somewhere and let them, you know, eat in peace and in quiet without them seeing. And then they would come back and the food would all be there, but the essence of the food would be gone, okay? And so they would wash the mouth of the god and the hands of the god and take the water after they had washed it, and this would become holy water for oblations. And then they would pick up the residue of the feast and send it to the king. And the king would eat it, who is the earth god. He would eat the rest of it and give it to whoever he felt was worthy to eat it. It was a sacramental meal, all right? And so, remember back in the book of Daniel, where Daniel is seeing the king's feast, and he's saying, I don't want to eat that. Lord, help me to have favor with these people so I won't have to eat that meal. He knew that to do that, he was being subsumed into the system. Okay? So he resisted that. This is the celestial system. All right. Now, it began to develop in certain places that, you know, if there is a wheel in the sky, then there must be one below the earth, too, because there's another realm down there. And if so, then we need to tie into the axle of the abyss as well. And so what this does is it begins to bring blessings and cursings up and down. But the whole thing has to work that way, you know. And the mythological system is built around this kind of action, you know, between what is above and what is below, the dualism of the good and the evil. Because you don't just give the gods their day, you have to give the devils theirs as well. And so we have to tie into that in order that we might have, you know, we never want to only see one side of anything. We want to make sure we're seeing both sides all the time, the good side, the evil side, the good side, the evil side, whatever it is that we define. And so this, in a nutshell, is the system. This is the celestial system. This is what it has turned into. Now, changes started taking place. And these changes probably began somewhere around the 10th century B.C. Up to that time, the system worked in which each little nation could have its own world navel, its own little city-state that had its corresponding celestial. Sometimes, if it didn't work out too good, you might want to move your city over, as Akkad did during the Akkadian period, move to Ur, because Ur was a better nexus for them to be in. Nineveh is going to be the one of Assyria. It's going to move between Memphis and Thebes and Amarna in Egypt. And so on and so on. These places here where you have the best advantage of being in the cosmological center. And the cities didn't have to be round in shape. Some were, interestingly enough. Some were shaped just like wheels. But they didn't have to be, because this was a spiritual correspondence here. All right? And it all works fine as long as everything stays the same. But things didn't stay the same. Men are always on the move. As long as you can stay powerful enough, you can keep your national boundaries in place. But as time goes along, money starts running out of Mesopotamia. Money starts running out of Egypt. Desertification starts taking place. The great grasslands that made it possible to have the enormous cattle industry of Egypt begins to run out as the deserts begin to creep further and further into Egypt. God's wrath looking over the Near East, in which almost everything becomes desertified over time, creeps into it. Once powerful nations begin to weaken, and because they weaken, their effect on the lesser nations is less, and so the power nexus begins to move in other directions. Say, you know, around the time of Isaiah, we actually see it moving from Egypt to Assyria. And all these changes start taking place, plus the creeping in of greater and greater degrees of corruption. And what does that do to the world? Well, it denudes the world of its people. The wars get bigger. There's greater populations of war. The conquest wipes out more populations. You can see this reflected in the demographics of the size of armies in the decline as you go from somewhere around, say, the 13th, 14th century B.C. to by the time you get to the Greek period. Here you have armies of hundreds of thousands. Here you have armies of thousands. All right. It picks back up again into the Roman period, but not much. You know, great massive dyings in the world. Plagues, starvation, war, all kinds of things going on. And poverty begins to creep in more and more too. The economic system start to change. And so what we see is more and more the civilizations beginning to slip into chaos. They're beginning to lose that parallelism and to slip more and more into chaos. And right around the 7th century, and I think we can actually nail this down to the Chaldeans. Right around the 7th century, somebody came up with this idea. It might have been Nebuchadnezzar II himself, the great, the one we know in the Bible. It may have been him himself, or it may have been somebody advising him from among the Chaldeans. I think it was him. I think he was the great genius here, and this was an inspiration. And that is, why should we be powered by the wheel up here? Why don't we become the flywheel and start powering that one up there? In other words, let's turn this thing over on its head. Let's be the primary principle. And let heaven, so to speak, follow in our lead instead. And when this idea cropped up and became implemented in the Babylonian Empire, what we see here is the birth of the modern state. It is the birth of the modern state. The state as God. The state as the heavenly realm. This is Nebuchadnezzar's dream. It is even reflected in the book of Daniel. You remember in the book of Daniel, where Nebuchadnezzar makes an image in the plain of Dura. All right. Now, the plain of Dura is not any kind of a special place, except that it is a great plain. It is a place where he can get a lot of people there. And he builds a pedestal there, and he builds an image. And the image is a 1-to-10 ratio image. And what that means is that the image that he builds, and you know, if you look in the Bible storybooks, the image he builds is always that image that he dreams about, right? That's not the image. The image is an obelisk. It's an obelisk. The description in the scriptures proves that it's an obelisk by giving us its dimension, because that's the exact dimension of a gnomon, okay? A gnomon is basically a needle for tracking the sun. That's what the that's what Cleopatra's needle is. It's an obelisk, all right? The Washington Memorial, that's an obelisk, all right? Obelisks were built all over the world in every culture. Cultures not even connected to each other had obelisks, all right? And I think they were nothing more than just what was left over of the old gnomon, which was used as a sun clock to be able to track time. The needle, the shadow of the needle would be cast upon a great stone that, as it was passing over that stone, it's marking off time. And in time, this became a symbol of order, of cosmic order, all right? Now this is not an image as an image of a man. It's an image of a symbol. It is somewhere between our cosmic axle rod and something else. All right. I mean, and there are other meanings behind it that we probably don't need to get into with children around. But the bottom line is that. This is the sign of a new order. He takes a minor, a relatively minor symbol, and moves it into first place here in the plain of Dura, and he says, "This right here is what I want you to worship." Notice who he wants to worship it. He gathers together not all of the people of the land, but all of his officials. In other words, he gets all of his civil magistrates together. He gathers them into this place, and he says to them, "Bow down and worship that." What does that represent? That represents the state. It is the state. And what he's saying to them is, we are now the ones who are going to run the universe. The cosmological system now is in our hands. The destiny of mankind lies with us. Man is now going to be the controller. All right, he's gotten over his fear of the flood now, and now he has a new attitude, and the new attitude is, we have no fear of God, and we are going to run our own destiny from now on. Forget about reference to God in heaven. Forget about reference to the divine. Now, interestingly enough, God comes along and teaches Nebuchadnezzar about himself. And in the end of it, I believe Nebuchadnezzar truly becomes a believer. But unfortunately, it's too late. He's created the system, and man likes it. And the reason why man likes the system and that it picks up speed as it goes along is because it fits so nicely into some of the transitional developments that have been going on up to this point in time. All right, so I want to end out. Let me see how much time we got left. Okay, this is it. Good. I want to end out with an observation coming from Assyriology here, and it is the ritual of the bull drum. All right, which illustrates better than anything I can see in ancient history the transition that's going on in here away from the old pagan system into the new, all right? There's something changing in man's mind about what his relationship to the spiritual world and to the prerogatives of the divine are. In other words, he's starting to change his mind about heaven. He's starting to change his mind about the gods. He's starting to change his mind about his subordinate place in the world, all right? And it comes out in an interesting ritual that takes place every time the head of the drum, the kettle drum, which is used for exorcism, is changed. You know, after beating the drum long enough, it's going to wear out and you've got to change it. But you don't change that drum head without going through a major ritual. And here's why. And we get the account of this from two texts. We get it from what's called the Assur text, which is the old Assyrian text, and another one from the Ugaritic text, which is much later, centuries later. But both of them give an account of the ritual of the bull drum. Now, it's called the bull drum because the skin that covers that drum is made from a bull's hide. And the attitude of the worshipers to the bull is what we want to watch. We want to look very carefully at how in the Assur text the votives there are dealing with the bull, and how in the Ugaritic text they're dealing with the bull. And there's a total change in attitude between the few centuries that go by leading up to that time. Originally, according to the Assur text, when you went about changing out the bull drum, the skin of it, you didn't just go to the tanner and get a hide and do it. You had to bring the bull in, which was a divine animal. All right? And this was not just one that came out of the herd. This was one that had been sacredized. It was like the Apis bulls of Egypt. It had a pedigree going back to an original god bull. And so these bulls represented kings and gods. As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. But the chronology has been set straight in Egypt by watching the progression of the Apis bulls throughout their record through Egyptian history, and comparing that with the king's lists and straightening things out that way, because the Apis bulls were sacrificed in Egypt far more often than kings lived and died. So they're able to get a much better chronology by watching those bull sacrifices that take place. All right, here's what happens. In the most ancient time, when you go to kill the bull, remember this, you're killing a god when you do that. This wasn't uncommon in ancient times and even in primitive cultures, because to kill an animal was to kill something with a spirit. And that something with a spirit had a certain divinity to it. So therefore, you see this in American Indian culture, where when they kill a deer, they apologize to it after they've done it and said, "I'm sorry to do this, nothing personal, but I've got to do this to feed my family, and you will live on in our flesh," and all this kind of good stuff, okay? And so, there's a little ritual that you do. Well, that same ritual is done in Assyria, except on a much higher level. Here they take the bull in, sacrifice the bull, and immediately as they sacrifice, and after they sacrifice it, they skin the bull, lay it out in a certain way for the sacrifice, and then they go through these deep rituals where the one who actually killed the bull will say, "It's not my fault." That's what he tells the bull. He says, "It's not my fault. The gods made me do it. Blame it on them." All right? And so his ritual is basically to say to the bull, "I am not guilty of this." And what does that reflect in his relationship to the bull? It reflects in him a deep submission to what he believes to be divine. Okay? I mean, it was a terrible thing to kill the divine bull. But I'm sorry, it's absolutely necessary. The gods say we have to do this or we're not going to satisfy them. And not only that, we can't drive evil spirits off unless it's got your hide on it, which has to come off of you, so you've got to die, you've got to be burned. And as a bonus, I'm just going to tell you this right now. I'm not going to eat any of the meat. All of these other guys can eat the meat. I'm not going to eat it, okay? So he's talking to this dead bull here, and he's telling him all these things, all right? Because he wants to make sure that the bull understands that. This is all a part of the ritual. And all of this conversation that he does is in song and in poetic form that's done over and over and over again in ritual in order to see to it that we have a drum that is actually going to drive evil spirits out. It's going to have the magic in it to do that. The Ugaritic text gives us the same ceremony performed several hundred years later. We're not quite sure how many, but probably it could be as much as 800 years later. The Ugaritic is probably a few hundred years older than the Assur text, but the Assur text has roots that go back for much further than that. So the same ceremony is being done, but there's been some changes in the ceremony. Now in the ceremony, you kill the bull, you do all of the stuff exactly the same way that you did on the Assur text. Nothing is left out whatsoever except one thing, and that's the conversation between the killer and the bull. Totally left out. Totally left out. He has no regard for the bull whatsoever. It's just an animal. And the reason why we know that is because when they went to bury the remains of the bull in the Assur text period of time, they buried him in the manner of a great king. But when they go to bury the bull after the Ugaritic version, he is simply buried in a common grave as if he were a man. Okay? Something's happened in their attitude towards their sacrifice here and towards their gods. And their attitude towards their gods. They no longer have that subordination and high reverence anymore. They no longer see the need of their personal expiation. To them, it has now just become a mechanistic, rote practice. You do this, it works. Kind of like the Aborigine and his boomerang. If you do all these things, it'll fly. All right? Now they've gotten to the point to where they don't even know the mysteries anymore and don't care. The only thing they care about is getting the skin off that bull as fast as they can, getting it on that drum so that it'll drive out evil spirits, and having themselves some good beef, sandwiches or whatever, okay, after it's all over with. All right? Get the job done. That's the Ugaritic text. Major shift has taken place here. A major shift. The reverence, the fear of the gods or the fear of the divine, the dependence upon the heavenly wisdom. All of these things are going away. They don't have it anymore. They're beginning to look at the world in a far more mechanistic and more utilitarian way. All right? This comes right about the time, the Ugaritic text, this comes right about the time Nebuchadnezzar comes along. And Nebuchadnezzar's got a whole different attitude. He has an attitude that we can render this, okay? You know, okay, we've got this religion, we've got these people doing all this stuff and all these rituals and all that kind of stuff, but we want to control it. We want to figure out a way of rendering all of this spiritual stuff, okay, and make it work to our advantage so that we can bring about order into the world. This all is taking place when more and more stresses are coming upon the world. Desertification, economies going down, armies dropping, populations dropping, violence running rife all over the place, sacrificial systems worse than ever before. The same thing's going on, not here, but it's also going in the Mediterranean. It's also going on in India. It won't be too long after this before Buddha comes along looking for some way to stop all the violence. And Confucius and the Jainist system and so forth in China is looking for some way to bring order so that all of the Mongol raids and all of the overthrows of dynasties and everything will stop and all the bloodletting will be stopped over time. The world is getting more and more and more dangerous. The old system's not working. There is a need for new systems to come along. And the need for the new systems is a need not just for the systems themselves, but for the power of the systems. There needs to be great power, and that great power needs to be able to control vast regions. And what's that going to be? The only thing in this world that actually resembles a god is a nation, a state. A state is something that is huge. It sees widely. Its power is over a vast region. It doesn't last just in the period of one man's life. It is an extended entity that goes on through many lifetimes. It's like a god, all right? And this is where man can finally lay claim to something. We, mankind, have taken a hold of our own destiny now. And this is new paganism. Now, it doesn't wipe old paganism out. It just simply begins to subsume it into a new system that can be channeled into human control. And when we... I don't think we get into that tonight, because we're going to recapitulate mythology and then have a biblical argument against mythology. And then when we get together tomorrow, then we'll start talking about what effect this has on human thinking. Man is going to come away from his mythopoeism a little bit more, and he is going to drift more into a rational way of looking at things, stripping all of the unnecessary ritual out, as we've seen with the bull drum, okay? Already he's beginning to examine his ritual systems, and he's trimming the fat off of it and getting it down to its naked rational functions more and more. And the more he does this, the more he's creating a new system of thought, a system of thought that is less religious, less mythological, and more what we begin to call philosophical, all right? And this comes out of these transitions that we're beginning to see. So what I hope that we can prove in this is that philosophy didn't rise up ex nihilo. Philosophy is rising up out of the mythological system. And it's going to borrow a lot of the material from the mythological system.